Now, if you have your Bible open in front of you, I'd like to start by just looking at this chapter. Just actually look down at it. If you didn't bring a Bible with you, then stare at your knee during this time. But if you do have a Bible with you, then just look at it. And you have verse 1 all the way through to verse 45. And if you stop at verse 35, verse 1 to 35 covers about 400 years of history. And Gary, if I could just get just a touch more volume, I'd appreciate it. That time covers about 400 years of history. And it is the time of Daniel to about 145 BC. And here is the reason that God gives us this history. And I'll tell you what, it is detailed history. I'm kind of a history buff, and I love covering stuff like this. I've been just enjoying my time in the study over the last couple of weeks doing research. I will take a verse and then go to the corresponding event in history, and I've just mapped this whole thing out. I'd love to take the rest of the morning and just go step by step by step through the history of these 400 years with you guys. Although some of you would be bored to tears if that were the case, others of you who just enjoy history, you'd be loving it. You'd be really going in. But we don't have time to be able to cover it like that. So we have to ask ourselves the question, why does this chapter cover that 400 years of history? Remember, to us, it's in the past. When it was written, it was prophecy. Daniel was telling the future. This angel was revealing the future to Daniel. Now, it's 2,000 years past to us. And it is so accurate that the critics of the Bible will tell you that this chapter could not have been written 600 BC. It's too accurate. Every twist and turn during that 400 years politically is covered by these guys. And if they're, you know, they've taken the stance that the Bible isn't true, that God didn't write it. So what are they going to do with a spectacular chapter like chapter 11 if they don't believe that the Bible is true? The only thing that they can do is go, they have no other proof, by the way, no other reason to believe that this was written later than 600 BC. Later than 600 BC. They have no proof for that. And so they just say, it's too accurate. Now, I believe that God has signed the Bible. That God has said, I've written this book. And his signature is the fact that this book tells the future. So they call it too accurate. I call it God's signature. How do I know that I can trust this and not the Book of Mormon? How do I know that I can trust this and not the Quran? How do I know that I can trust this and not the Hindu writings or the Buddha writings or the Krishna writings? Because God signed this by telling the future. And if God can tell the future and he's written it for us to check out and see, then God knows the future. God knows where we're going. He knows my future. It becomes a very personal thing. And he knows the future of this world. Now, I just want to give you a feel of what these 35 verses are like. So let's cover the first three verses. And this just gives us a feel. That's all I want to do. I don't want to cover all the information here, but I just want to cover the first three verses to give you a feel of what these 35 verses are like. It says in verse 1, also in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. This is an angel speaking. He has revealed to Daniel that there is a very real spiritual world behind the scenes. The demonic spirits of Persia and Greece are battling. And the angel says, I have strengthened Darius the Mede, which is an interesting verse because it tells us that angels sometimes strengthen world leaders. That's interesting, isn't it? Sometimes angels come alongside world leaders and strengthen them, as this angel did with Darius the Mede. But then in verse 2, he gets right into his information. Remember, this is prophecy from this perspective, but to us it's history. Verse 2 says, and now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. So he says there's going to be three more Persian rulers. One of them's going to be strong. The last one's going to be stronger than the others, and he's going to stir up Greece. Now, this is the great Persian ruler Artaxerxes, known as Xerxes as well. Artaxerxes did stir up Greece. Artaxerxes decided that he wanted to march on Athens. When the people of Greece got together, and remember, this is before Philip of Macedonia, it's before Alexander the Great, they were a loosely knit group of nations. They kind of came together when they needed to protect their region, but they mostly fought against each other. That's what the area of Greece did at this time. Sparta was one of those areas, and Sparta, it's interesting, was a nation of warriors. They would take, how would you like guys to grow up in Sparta? They would take their kid at 7 years old, take them away from their family, put them into a school of war, where all they were taught was war. And the way they trained these guys to fight in battle was at age 7, the soldiers beat them up every day. That's what they did. They beat them up every day until they were men. And I tell you what, you take a beating every day until you're a man, and you're able to give a beating by the time you're a man. These men, the Spartan warriors, were the most feared in the region. There was no one more feared than a Spartan soldier because he had learned how to fight since the time that he was a youngster. In fact, they pitted them against each other. You know, kind of tap out kind of a thing. They just fought until blood was drawn, and one of them could not get up. That's how they trained these people. Well, Artaxerxes decided that he wanted to march on Athens, which is kind of a mistake. And when he did this, the region got together. They normally fought against each other, but the region got together because here's this great, you know, warrior coming against them. He's got a fleet of ships coming in, and they lead him into a pass, and they defeat him. It's a huge defeat against Artaxerxes. And if there's anything Artaxerxes doesn't like, it is a defeat. So he goes back home and he licks his wounds and he sends out an army. Some historians believe that the army was as many as 1 million people that he sent over. Others say 500,000. Some believe it could be as small as 160 or 170,000 men that marched on Athens. When you look at the area of Artaxerxes' kingdom in Persia, what is Iran today, and you look at Greece, and you realize where they have to go to get there, an army marching that far is phenomenal. They, in fact, made a bridge that was about 1 mile long so they could cut a huge part of their march out of the way. When they got there, the Greeks were ready for them. It was the first time that they really pulled together. They pulled together completely. They put certain armies in certain regions from different countries. And the Spartans, which I told you about before, put a group of 300 soldiers led by a guy by the name of Leonidas. In a canyon, really it was a pass, it was a valley that was about 100 yards long called Thermopylae, the Battle of Thermopylae. 165,000 Persians, that's the conservative number, against 300 Spartans. And the Spartans withheld the whole army of the Persians. It's an amazing account. Now, they had a couple thousand more. People like to leave out the fact that the rest of Greece had thrown in a few thousand people into the battle. But still, a few thousand people against this incredible army because they brought them down to a small pass. And they got into their formation. The Spartans got in their formation, their big square shields, their long, 8-foot-long spears. And when the Persians started shooting their arrows in there, they just put the shields over their heads. And history tells us they didn't lose anybody to any arrows. Which I don't know if that's, you know, an exaggeration of the fact, but that the arrows just didn't penetrate. They laughed from them under their shields, is what Herodias tells us, the historian. They just put their shields up, the arrows nailed into their shields, and they just laughed underneath their shields. Then they put them down, and the Persian army marched on them. Now, here's what happens with the Persian army. They start marching forward. There's I don't know how many in the first wave, thousands to be sure. They get funneled down to this area that's about 100 yards long, and the whole Persian army's pushing behind them. And they come up to the Spartans, which are lined up here in their formation, and when they march up to them, they suddenly realize the Spartans have swords, 8 feet long. They have spears, they have swords that are a couple feet long. The Spartans have spears that are 8 feet long. I'll get it right sooner or later. But they can't stop because they got an army marching in behind them. Imagine, you're in the front line, and you're marching up, and all of a sudden you realize, I got a sword. They have spears. It's going to be trouble. And they can't go back because here comes the army behind them, bump, bump, and everybody's keyed. Because what? In battle, you can see that, can't you? Everybody's like, war! They're running in. They're all keyed up. They're all running. These guys in the front are trying to stop, and they are shoved into the swords of the Spartans, literally. And they slaughter them by the thousands. The next day, Artaxerxes is furious. He's so upset that he calls for his immortals. The immortals are his elite fighting forces. They wore veils over their face. They didn't scream when they went into battle. When one of them died, they replaced him with another. That's why they were called the immortals. They were always the same number. They came marching in, and they were elite. They were well-trained, but nothing like the Spartans. The Spartans, war was their life. The elite had certainly been trained in the art of war, but the Spartans, war was their life, and they slaughtered the immortals. The same thing happened. They marched in on them. They couldn't retreat. The immortals stood their ground. The Spartans stood their ground. And the immortals were slaughtered. Finally, Artaxerxes found a pass that went behind him. The group of people that were supposed to be guarding that pass abandoned it. And so Xerxes was able to get around behind them. Once they got around behind him, it was done. They put him between the two armies and they smushed them together and they destroyed them. But these group of couple of thousand people led by these 300 Spartans were able to withhold the Persian army for several days in this battle of Thermopylae. It's, you know, one of the all-time great stories, like, you know, David and Goliath, where the Greeks had been able to withhold them. The Persians then, in anger, you can imagine how upset Xerxes is at this point. He's been held up by these Spartans, and he's angry. He marches on Athens and burns it. And he burns the Parthenon, and he leaves. When he does this, Greece licks its wounds. Greece turns around and decides, let's never let this happen again, and they begin to build an army. It takes a little while for that army to build, but eventually Philip of Macedonia rallies them together. Philip of Macedonia marries a woman by the name of Olympias who has a son by the name of Alexander. Alexander becomes Alexander the Great. He rallies the Greek army, and the Greek army has one purpose in mind when they start. Alexander does not set out to conquer the world. Alexander sets out to destroy Persia. That's his goal. He trains his army, and he puts his army together that he can destroy Persia because of what they did to Athens when they burned it. And Alexander defeats them, and he defeats them soundly. Now let's read on here a little bit more. And I told you, if you're a history buff, you're going to love this today. If you're not, you're just like, what? Just shoot me in the head. Hot pokers in the eyes, anything. And when they had arisen, verse 3, then a mighty king shall arise who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. That's Alexander the Great. And when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided towards the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, not according to his dominion with which he ruled. The kingdom shall be uprooted even for others beside these. Alexander the Great defeated Persia, kept marching, defeated the whole world by the time he was 32. He died of a mysterious disease in Egypt. He had left two sons who were going to take his place, but they were killed. In a struggle for power after his death, they were killed. And it was divided between his four generals. Out of his four generals, two of them became strong, the Egypt region and the Syrian region. Now, if in your mind you can get where they are, don't think of our region of the world, the south and the north. Don't think of Mexico and Canada. Think of their region of the world, Egypt and Syria. Syria is the whole entire region between Europe and the Middle East. That was what was called Syria in their day. Egypt was really, you could go back into all Africa. And the Ptolemy dynasty, a general by the name of Ptolemy, took the Egyptian-African region. The Seleucid dynasty, a general by the name of Seleucus, took the area of Syria. And the other two kind of dwindled away, became really non-factors, but this southern kingdom and this northern kingdom, or the southern dynasty, the Ptolemy dynasty and the Seleucid dynasty, they fought against each other for a couple hundred years. It was a battle that raged, and the Seleucids would gain power, then the Ptolemies would gain power, then the Seleucids would gain power, then the Ptolemy would gain power. There were uneasy truces that were made. There were marriages between princes and princes in order to try to bring in truces, but none of it worked. That's from verse 3 through 21 of this chapter. That's what you get, is this great, you know, kind of struggle between the Ptolemy dynasty and the Seleucid dynasty. Until verse 21... we are introduced to a ruler in the Seleucid dynasty. Let's pick it up there. And in his place shall arise a vile person. Now, you've been introduced to this guy if you've been with us in the book of Daniel. His name is Antiochus Epiphanes. The word Epiphanes means manifested by God. The Jews called him Antiochus Epiphanes, madman. Antiochus the madman is what they called him. He was a vile person, the Bible tells us, to whom they will not give honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. The very first thing that we learn about Antiochus Epiphanes was that when he comes on the scene, he doesn't come with an army. He comes peaceably and with intrigue. In other words, he flattered his way into ruling. He wasn't in the lineage for the throne. He killed his brother who was in line for the throne. And then he himself flattered the people in power to become king. And he ran on a platform of peace, claiming that he could bring peace to the region. What they didn't know about Antiochus Epiphanes is that he was a madman, and he was a man bent on war, very much like Hitler. Do you know that when Hitler came to power, he ran on a platform of peace? Isn't that interesting? Hitler comes on the scene, and Germany is in disarray. Economically, it's a mess. Europe all over is in this uneasy peace, if you could even call it that, during the time that Hitler comes to power. And he declares that he's able to bring peace to all of Europe. That was his platform by which he came to power and became the Chancellor of Germany. They didn't know what they got. They brought him in, and what they got was a madman like Antiochus Epiphanes, a man who was bent on war and the destruction of the Jewish people. It's interesting when you look for parallels between Hitler and Antiochus Epiphanes, how many parallels there are between the two. They were both eventually defeated. They both hated the Jews. They both started out with the platform of peace, and they both became mass murderers. Very, very similar kinds of people. And I believe that Antiochus Epiphanes and Hitler are both previews of the last world ruler that we know as the Antichrist. That one who will be in charge when this world comes to an end. This world is marching day by day by day to a horrific 7-year period that the Antichrist will be in charge and prospering during that time. Antiochus Epiphanes is a foreshadowing of that. Now, what happens to Antiochus? Antiochus continues the feud with the Ptolemies, and he's marching on Egypt, and he was ignoring the fact that there was another power in the region. You guys know the power. It was Rome. Rome came on the scene while these Ptolemies and Seleucids were battling against themselves. Rome got the opening, the opportunity for them to seize power, and they did. And while Antiochus Epiphanes was marching on the Ptolemies again, Rome sent ships from Cyprus to stop him. That was their mission, to stop Antiochus. They showed up and they stopped him. And the general, the Roman general that stopped him, took out a sword, and he walked up to Antiochus, and he drew a line in the sand around him. That's where the saying, a line in the sand, comes from. He actually drew a line in the sand completely around Antiochus Epiphanes. And he told him, if you step out of this circle, I'll kill you, unless you abandon your campaign against Egypt and you submit to Roman rule. Well, this was Antiochus' choice. Submitting to Roman rule and abandoning his campaign against the Ptolemies, or die. Antiochus wasn't that stupid, and so he pledged allegiance to Rome, and he abandoned his campaign against the Ptolemies, and he stepped across that circle, and he lived. But think about the type of person that Antiochus Epiphanes was. When he is forced to do something he did not want to do, from here on out, he does have allegiance to Rome, by the way. He becomes a kind of an arm of Rome, a rebellious arm of Rome, but he becomes an arm of Rome after this. What do you know about a person like that? They would turn in anger on others. He couldn't go after Egypt because Rome would destroy him if that was the case. And so he turned back around to head back home to the north, and what was in his way? Before he got to Syria again, what was the very first place he would ever reach? Israel. Look at verse 30. It says, for ships from Cyprus shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant to do damage. Verse 31, and forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress, and they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. This is when Antiochus turns on Israel. 80,000 men, women, or children are slaughtered by him in Jerusalem. He takes another 40,000 captive, and he sells another 40,000 into slavery. It is a horrific time for Israel, but they pull together. And through the Maccabean revolt, they defeat Antiochus eventually. It's a horrible 7 years, but through the Maccabean revolt, and it's a whole other aspect of history that if you've never studied the Maccabean revolt, it is absolutely phenomenal. And I believe that God actually fought on the side of Israel to defeat Antiochus Epiphanes and to restore them during that particular point in time. Now, Antiochus becomes a preview of this last world ruler. We have him turning against Israel here. And then in verse 36, now look back at the chapter again. I had you look at the whole thing. Then I had you look from verse 1 to 35. Now look at verse 36 through 45. Those are 10 verses that give us the future from us. The first 35 verses did what? gave us the past that was future to them, but was the past to us. We've looked at history. Now we get to look forward. What this world is coming to. I said earlier, every day this world marches closer to its end. One day this world will end. There are people that believe that it will end by global warming. There are, and it seems there are endless movies that are coming out about how bad we are with global warming. There are others that believe that this world is actually going to freeze. The opposite of global warming, that the core of the earth is actually cooling off at a particular rate. The sun is actually dwindling down. There will be a point when there is so cold on the earth that we will not be able to support life. Two different theories, supported by scientists, by the way. One that the earth is going to cook, and the other one that the earth is going to freeze. And I guess the ones that believe it's going to cook eventually believe it's going to freeze as well. I understand that. So before you scientists come and correct me, I do understand that. All right? Nevertheless, the Bible tells us that Jesus Christ is going to come back and that God's going to judge this world before he does. When we hear about that, we think, why is God going to judge the world? It doesn't seem fair. He's going to judge the world and he's going to destroy it and men are going to be killed by a very act of God. Why? Because God's a judge. God is the judge of this world. Imagine if a man was caught raping and killing in your neighborhood. And he's brought before a judge. And the judge says to this man, you know, you look like a nice fella. I'm going to go ahead and let you go. How would you feel if that judge just let a man who killed and raped in your neighborhood go? You would say, what an unjust judge. That man's not a judge. He's not doing his job. Well, how is it that you think that God can just let people go if he is a judge? The Bible tells us he's a judge. Now, the world wants to reject it, but God is a judge, and God will one day judge this world. So on the other end, you think, what's he waiting for? Which is really funny because people will say, I'm really upset at God because I don't think he ought to judge the world. And then when you read the newspaper, you go, if I were God, I'd get him. What's God waiting for? Look at the horrible things people are doing. And in fact, if you were the judge of the universe, I realize that's a stretch, but let's just say you were the judge of the universe and you had to judge men based upon what they did, I hardly think you'd go through a night before you said, that's it, I'm done. I'm taking these people out. But God is long-suffering, the Bible says, not because he's slack concerning his promises, Peter tells us, but because he desires that all would be saved and all would come to the knowledge of the truth. The reason that God hasn't judged this world so far is he wants people to get saved. But make no mistake about it, this world is marching day by day by day to a 7-year period that is worse than anything this world has ever seen and worse than anything it will ever go through. During that time, the Antichrist will kill hundreds of millions, perhaps even billions of people. He will make Hitler look like a lightweight. He certainly will make Antiochus Epiphanes look like a lightweight. The interesting thing, as we're going to see in a moment, is he comes to power by peace, just like Antiochus and Hitler. And he's a war machine. He's a madman that loves war, just like Antiochus and Hitler. And he has a very distinct end. Just like Hitler put a bullet in his head, Antiochus was eventually defeated and killed, so the Antichrist is going to be defeated and killed. His reign will come to an end. Now, that's what we find here in this chapter. In verse 36, it says, and this is talking now not about Antiochus Epiphanes, but about the Antichrist. Then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god and speak blasphemies against the God of gods and shall prosper till the time of wrath has been accomplished. The tribulation period in the Old Testament is called the time of God's wrath, the time of God's indignation. The Antichrist is going to prosper during that 7-year trial and tribulation period. It says, for what has been determined shall be done. God says, I'm telling you this because it's determined and it will be done. There's no way to change it. You might think that God would tell us what's going to happen because we might be able to come in and change it, but that's not why he's telling us. It is determined and it will happen. Now, it goes on to tell us a little bit more about the Antichrist. First of all, it says in verse 37, he shall regard neither the God of his fathers. Some believe that means he's Jewish, but it doesn't say that. It simply says he doesn't regard the God of his fathers. In other words, he's brought up religious, but at one point he rejects that religion. Whatever religion he's brought up in, and we don't know what that is, he rejects it. He doesn't regard the God of his fathers. But then it says, nor does he desire women. Now, what does it mean when the Antichrist doesn't desire women? We know he rejects the God of his fathers. He doesn't desire women. Well, there's a few thoughts. First of all, some believe that he's a homosexual. Doesn't desire women, therefore, he's a homosexual. Maybe. Others believe it means he just hates women. That like some men that just despise and hate women, he's one of those kind of men. He's a sexist who just turns against women. Only turns against Jews more than he turns against women. Perhaps. Perhaps that really is the makeup of the Antichrist. Maybe that's what it means when it says he doesn't desire women. But there was another thought that I was introduced to probably a decade ago, maybe 15 years ago, that I rejected immediately, but I'm beginning to give it a little bit more thought now. And that is that the Antichrist actually has brought up Islam. Now, if he rejects his religion, the religion of his fathers, that we knew he would reject Islam eventually, but that he's brought up Islam. Now, the reason I give that a little bit more thought, I think, is kind of obvious. 40% of the world's population is Islam today. Did you know that? It's a huge percentage of the world's population that is Islam. And there is no other political group or religious group that mistreats women like Islam does. In Islamic nations, women are under the greatest oppression of anywhere in the world, which is interesting to me that there are certain people that normally defend women's rights that are now defending Islam. And I wonder, how can you do that? How can you be a defender of women's rights and a defender of Islam when Islam is the greatest violator of women's rights? Women that live in Muslim countries have no rights. They are possessions of their husbands, and that is all. They can be beaten. They can be abandoned. It's just, there are absolutely no rights. And so the more I think about it, the more I think it's possible. In fact, who in our day would be lifted up more than a Muslim that brings peace to Israel? Now, you might think, come on, the United States isn't going to follow a Muslim. But wait a minute, he's not a United States leader. He's a world leader. The world embraces him. The fact that we might not embrace him as a nation, we might. But the fact that we might not embrace him as a nation doesn't mean anything. We're only a small part of the world makeup, who now is increasingly more Muslim all of the time. They are on a move to make the world Muslim by population, just by having as many Muslim children as they possibly can, taking over the percentage of the world by doing that. So that's a possibility. Am I saying he's Muslim for sure? No. So don't quote me. Don't go out, Robert said he's Muslim, the Antichrist is Muslim. All I'm saying is it's a possibility, all right? I'm not saying he is. The interesting thing is when you get to the future, now things are a little bit fuzzy. When you look at the first part of this chapter, it's clear. Boom, that's that, that's that, that's that. Now you look and go, well, maybe this, maybe that. All right, so we go on. Verse 37, no regard for any god, and he shall exalt himself above them all. But in their place, he shall honor the god of fortress. In other words, he comes on the scene in peace, but he becomes a warrior. He gets voted in as world ruler, but in the middle of it, people rebel against him. And when they rebel against him, he takes his army and he conquers the world, or attempts to conquer the world with his army. He turns into a warrior king, as it were. Pick it up in verse 40. At that time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him. We'll take it, that's again not Mexico, that's Egypt. The king of the south shall attack him. The king of the north, not Canada, probably Russia, shall come against him like a whirlwind. At that time, Egypt and Russia, or maybe Africa and Russia, some believe, the south would be Africa, turn against him. And he goes against Egypt, and the north comes against him like a whirlwind with many ships, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. He just sends his army down into Egypt and Africa, and Lydia and Israel, and he just dominates the area. He cuts through them like a hot knife through butter. He just passes through. There's no resistance at all. He just dominates those parts of the world. It says he will also enter the glorious land, which is Israel. Many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the people of Ammon. There's an interesting study with just those three, by the way. Jeremiah also tells us that they will not be taken in the last days. The Antichrist, for whatever reason, can't take these people groups. And he will stretch out his hand against the countries of the land of Egypt, and they shall not escape. And he shall have power over the treasuries of gold and silver and over the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and the Ethiopians, that would be Africa, shall follow at his heels. He just dominates that part of the world. So you put that in your mind. He takes Africa, Egypt, the Middle East, and maybe Europe. All of that taken quickly by him when he brings out his war machine. Verse 44, but news from the east and north shall trouble him. What's the east? China. China today boasts of an army of 200 million people. The Bible tells us that an army of 200 million people will march from the east in the last days, that the Euphrates River will dry up to allow them to come in. So he hears news from the east and from the north. The north then would be Russia, both of them communist nations. Again, I'm speculating now some, right? I'm just thinking who's north and who's east and who would have the power to be able to trouble him. And I believe it would be Russia and China. I could be wrong, but I believe it is. So he hears verse 44 again. But news from the east and from the north trouble him. Therefore he shall go out with great fury and destroy and annihilate many. When he hears this news, most likely that there's an army coming from the north and an army coming from China to engage him. He, with great fury, sets out to conquer the rest of where he's going to conquer. And then he sets his tents in Israel. Look at verse 45. And he shall plant his tents in his place between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. The glorious holy mountain is Zion, Jerusalem. The seas are the Mediterranean seas. Directly in between those two, if you draw a straight line, you pass through the Valley of Megiddo. What takes place in the Valley of Megiddo? The last battle this world will ever see, called Armageddon. What the Antichrist does is he conquers Africa, Egypt, probably Europe, and the Middle East. And then when he hears that the armies are coming from Russia and from China, he sets up battle in a strategic location, a place you could have a battle of this size, one of the only places in the world you could have a battle of this size. The Valley of Megiddo has been the site of multiple wars because it is a huge, flat area that you can engage. He sets up his forces in the Valley of Megiddo, and he waits. When the Chinese army shows up and when the Russian army shows up, they're ready to battle against each other. If he can win this battle, he will conquer the entire world. Now, not voted in as a political leader, but now he will conquer the entire world. However, verse 45, and he shall plant the tents of the palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. The Antichrist will die there. Like Epiphanes lost it, like Hitler lost it, the Antichrist will die there in Megiddo. How does he die? In the middle of his battle, the sky rolls back, and Jesus Christ comes through in all of his glory. The Bible says he's riding upon a white horse, and King of Kings and Lord of Lords is written on his thighs, and 10,000s of thousands are with him. Why do I raise my hand? Because I'm one of them. And the Bible says he destroys the Antichrist with the sword that proceeds from his mouth. And I love that it just finishes him. You got the Antichrist, and he conquers all this world, and he hears the news in the north and the east, and he gets together in Megiddo. He's ready to fight him, and then he's done. It's like anticlimactic. It's like going to a movie where the villain is killed in a minute. Boom, there's rolling the credits. What? Got to have a better ending than that. But the Antichrist doesn't have that kind of an ending, because the Antichrist really has false power. He gets his power from the dragon, which is the devil. Now, I'm a little over time. I need to wrap it up. But why does God give us this chapter? Does that seem odd to anybody? He gives us all of this history in the beginning of chapter 11. He gives us this detailed account of the Antichrist during the tribulation period and how he's going to be in power and then have to bring out the military. And then he's going to conquer a certain part of the world, but he's going to have trouble with another part. And it all culminates in Megiddo for the Battle of Armageddon. Why? Why would God give us that? And in this chapter tell us these things are determined. There's no way it's going to change. This world's marching towards those. You might think if God's going to tell us the future, it could be like a one scenario. If things don't change, this is what's going to happen. So you Christians need to go out and do this so you can change it. But the Bible doesn't say that. It says these things are determined, they will take place. Well, if this world is marching towards this last day when this last world ruler will be in power and these events will play out, maybe in our lifetime, by the way, maybe in our children's lifetime, maybe in our grandchildren's lifetime, but sometime, I believe soon, these events will play out, then what kind of people ought we to be? See, we could come to church week after week, and I kind of prayed about this in my prayer opening, and I could give you warm, fuzzy sermons. I could talk to you about how life is so simple and comfortable and positive and good every single week. You could walk out of church going, my, I love those warm, fuzzy feelings. Or we can look at the truth. The truth is that there's despots in this world. The truth is there's God haters who will try to gain power because they have turned their back upon God. And if that's taking place, and this is the truth, and this is the world that we live in, then what kind of people ought we to be? God opens up a door for us to be able to peek through because God wants us to live a certain way now. I don't have time to waste on my own pleasures. I don't have time to waste living my own life. I now want to please God. I want to be used by Him so the people that are around me can see Christ in me, the hope and glory. And if God's being patient and waiting till the very end to set this whole thing off because He desires that all would be saved and all would come to the knowledge of the truth, then that's the business we ought to be about. That all would be saved and all would come to the knowledge of the truth. God reveals these things to us like His friends, like his children, saying, listen, be with me. Do the work with me. People are perishing. We need to pray for them. We need to live in front of them like we're supposed to. We need to weed the sin out of our lives and live holy lives before them so they can see the proof that Christ is in us, the hope of glory. That's what I believe chapter 11 of the book of Daniel tells us. That there's very serious business at hand. Before that tribulation period comes, you and I are going to be taken out of here. Now, a lot of people mock that today. People will say, well, no, the rapture of the church happens in the middle of the tribulation period or at the end of the tribulation period. And people will ask me, why do you believe it's in the before the tribulation period so much? I got a lot of reasons, but I'm just going to tell you one. And one is enough, by the way. Because Jesus said this. He said, you be ready because you don't know when I'm coming back. If He comes back in the middle of the tribulation period, I know when He's coming back. I made that point with somebody who's what we call a mid-tribber. I'm a pre-tribber, someone we call a mid-tribber. And they said, well, I believe Jesus is coming back in the middle of the tribulation period. And I said, okay, well, then you know what day He's coming back. And he goes, well, no. I don't know what day He's coming back. I think that it's going to be so chaotic during the tribulation period that you lose track of the calendar. You won't even know what day it is. Right. We're all going to go, is it Monday, Tuesday, Friday? I don't know. Everybody's lost track. What day it is, nobody's keeping track anymore about what day it is. So we don't know when Jesus is coming back, even though we know it's in the middle of the tribulation period. Doesn't make sense, does it? The end of the tribulation period, certainly you'll know. You're watching it all. You're watching the forces of the Antichrist, you know, all in the Valley of Megiddo for Armageddon. And you'd be going, well, Jesus is coming back pretty soon for us. Jesus has already come back for His church. He's coming back to establish His kingdom now. The only way that you would have to be ready all the time and not know when He's coming back is if He comes back any moment. And what happens for the people who say He's coming back in the middle of the tribulation period or the end of the tribulation period is they steal that any moment hope from you. Because now you no longer have to be ready. Even though Jesus said be ready, they say it's the middle of the tribulation period. I don't got to be ready. They say it's at the end of the tribulation period. I don't got to be ready. Even though Jesus said, be ready. Well, once again, I'd rather listen to Jesus than you. Sorry. He wins out. You tell me it's the middle. You tell me it's the end. Jesus tells me to be ready because I don't know when it's happening. I'm going to be ready because I don't know when it's happening. And it could be at any moment. He could come back for His church and take us to be with Him. God's timetable, remember, is on pause. He's TiVo'd it. It's played through partially in history, and it's on pause right now, but could be right now. He might be standing up in heaven and getting his little TiVo button. Boom, let's start it all again. Boom, the church goes, the tribulation period starts. It could be just around the corner. Let's live our lives in such a way that we show people around us Christ, the hope of glory. Let's stand up and pray.